The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation is from Martha Hoover, founder of Indianapolis restaurant group Potashoe Inc.
The Indianapolis food scene today is flourishing, receiving both national and international recognition. In fact, Indianapolis is becoming a food experience destination. In 1989, however, the local food scene was very different when our guest today, Martha Hoover, opened her first restaurant. Hoover, a former lawyer with no restaurant experience, opened Cafe Potashoe with the goal to prepare the best simple food using high-quality ingredients. This was an approach that many vendors said was a mistake because cheaper yet substandard ingredients were available. Fortunately, Martha ignored their advice, and customers immediately noted the difference in Potashoe's food quality, which has been the key to the success of the entire company. Growing up on the north side of Indianapolis in a family that always appreciated food, it was summer vacations in the Big Apple and a trip to Paris after graduating high school that introduced her to the concept now known as farm to table. Now, almost 30 years after opening her flagship restaurant, Hoover is founder and president of Potashoe Incorporated, an independently owned company operating a variety of unique restaurants that are acclaimed locally and nationally. Potashoe continues to expand with more restaurants set to open in the new year, including one I'm very excited about, Crispy Bird at 49th and Pennsylvania. It's going to be good. In September, Fortune and Time Inc. sister publication Food and Wine named Hoover one of the most innovative women in food and drink for 2017. The list recognizes women who had the most transformative impact in the last year on what we eat and drink. Recognizing the need to combat the poverty crisis in central Indiana, Hoover and her company established the Potashoe Foundation in 2013. Focusing on Indianapolis schoolchildren who are impacted by hunger, the Potashoe Foundation provides educational services on the importance of consuming whole food, has served over 50,000 sustainably grown and crafted local meals, and urges lawmakers to protect critical federal food assistance programs. The Potashoe Foundation is partially supported with 100% of the profits from Public Greens, a restaurant and micro farm on the Monon Trail. Now, please join me in welcoming Martha Hoover.
Thank you, Claire. Good afternoon, everybody. I have wanted to say thank you, Madam President, since November of last year. So thank you, Claire. Sorry about that, everybody. Seriously, my staff and I have been kind of beside ourselves since I got this invitation. You know, this great organization. I've been to several of these lunches, and I have to admit, first and foremost, I'm a little overwhelmed and a little nervous to be here. This is a huge crowd for me to be speaking in front of. But my first instinct when I got up here and looked out was, damn you, Economics Club of Indiana, you are ruining my lunch today at Potashoe on the Park. So, seriously. I'm very upset about that. So the Economics Club normally invites economists and policymakers and CEOs and CFOs and politicians. My staff and I have really laughed, thinking that this must be the ultimate sign of the apocalypse that you have now invited a restaurateur. I was given the task to talk about whatever is relevant in the restaurant world, and forgive me, I think this is my sole food pun, but I hope this is not too light a fare for you today. I've actually been on the road a lot over the last month. Jamie and I were just talking how October is conference month. Last 2 weeks ago, I was in D.C. at Restaurant High, which is the hospitality industry's version. It's like a G8 summit for the hospitality industry. And the week before that, I was in New York City at a conference on workplace culture, talking at both places about Pot au Chu and how it fits into the world of restaurants. It was easier talking in D.C. and talking in New York, because after all, those people, they don't know anything about my company. They have to take what I say at face value. But here, home audience, it's all remarkably verifiable. Sadly, it's all verifiable. And Claire, truly, thank you for that wonderful introduction. It's always nice being at these kind of events because the introductions are so positive. But don't worry, John, I don't think I told you this. We're taking my mother out to dinner tonight, and she will be sure to give the other side of that story. And speaking of my mother, she's 93 and lives at Marquette Manor, and I went to see her yesterday, and I sat down and had coffee with several of her friends, the youngest of whom is turning 90 this week. And they asked me what I was doing yesterday, and I told them I was writing a speech for this organization. And one of her friends, Libby, said, well, what are you talking about? I mean, what do they want you to talk about? And I said, well, I'm talking about restaurants and the world of food and all that. And she said, oh, darn it, Martha, I was hoping you were going to be talking about the resistance. So, yes, that's true. So there is a quote on the economics homepage by Teddy Roosevelt. And although, as a nation, we are now reexamining the men that we've memorialized through a modern, less paternalistic and colonistic lens. And by the way, I had to mention Libby because she approved that line. His quote still resonates today. His quote is that Indianapolis is America's most representative city. And I propose that if our city is truly a representative city, then the restaurant industry is its most representative industry. After all, it employs people from all walks of life, all religions, all nationalities, ethnicities, ages, backgrounds, educational levels. And as I prepared my thoughts for today, I really realized that I was actually writing three very separate love letters, so to speak. The first to the community, Roosevelt's representative city, for supporting me in my restaurants before food was chic. And the second letter, of course, is to the industry itself. It's so addictive and so wonderful. Every Monday, Matthew is here, he can tell you, the Monday after spring break, we get a million phone calls at the office from parents of high school kids asking if we are hiring for summer. And I always say to them, you may just want Junior off your sofa or out of the basement, but watch out. What you're going to get by getting Junior a job at a restaurant is a lifetime of restaurant work, because it is an incredibly exhilarating and addictive industry. But the third love letter goes to the people who actually work in the industry. The people who chop and prep and serve and clean and wake up before the crack of dawn and stay up hours past anyone's normal bedtime so that the rest of us can enjoy eating out. After all, these are the people themselves with aspirations and dreams for their lives and the lives of their children who daily help me make my dream a reality. And when I think of them, I'm actually reminded on almost a daily basis of one of my favorite Yeats poems, He Wishes for the Cloths of Heaven, which ends by stating, I have spread my dreams under your feet, tread softly because you tread on my dreams. And I hope to honor those people today. So it's true, as Claire stated, I opened my first cafe in 1989, having never worked in a restaurant. I was not a trained chef. I had no formal business training. And to be honest, I had never supervised any staff. I opened the first cafe not knowing that I was pregnant with my third child. So what should have been a complete recipe for disaster, almost 30 years later and 12 restaurants later, is a formula that seems to have worked. But because it's Potoshu, where we go through nearly 25,000 farm fresh, free range, mostly organic eggs a week, everything is referenced by eggs. We don't have a lot of balls in the air. We have a lot of eggs in the air. And for a little over 28 years, I have spent all of my days making sure that the eggs mostly stay up in the air and then figuring out what to do when one or two of them falls on the floor. Potoshu started small. We grew slowly and strategically with the continuous emphasis on being a bar-setting organization, and the brand Potoshu cannot be separated from its internal culture. Bloomberg just last week held its global business forum, and Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, spoke. He stated, "People should have values. Companies are nothing more than a collection of people. So by extension, all companies should have value." He further stated that as CEO of Apple, he thought his prime responsibility was to decide exactly what the values of Apple were. As founder and president of Potoshu, my prime responsibility has always been to set Potoshu's values. Our culture was built on the premise of being radically different and radically better, and we've been committed to those values since the day we opened. Scaling a people-centric culture that happens to serve damn good food has been my paradoxically simple and complicated at the same time overarching goal. Potoshu restaurant number 12, Crispy Bird, is opening on December 5th. We soon start construction for two satellite locations of Public Greens, one at the Fashion Mall and one downtown at the Cummins headquarters. Several additional locations of the mothership brand, Cafe Potoshu, are in the works, along with our own bakery, Flower Market. And I'm working on my pet project of shared feminist workspace deliberately named the Box Office. And I say deliberately because, thank you, I say deliberately because invariably when I talk about the Box Office, there's some guy in the audience, I don't know who you are, where you're sitting, but one of you is going to come up and say, do you know what that name means? And I just want to thank you in advance. I do know what it means. Thank you. Currently, with nearly, I told you, you guys should not have asked a restaurateur. We are way too ribald to be up here. Currently, with nearly 400 employees, an intact company culture, and an industry-defying lack of turnover, I'm often asked how I got, I'm back to the eggs now, how I got the souffle to rise in the first place. But I think the real question should be how, after almost 30 years, we keep the souffle from falling. As all of you cooks in the audience know, souffles may be mostly egg whites, but there's as much magic as science to getting one to occur. So I got the souffle to rise in 1989. I came to the industry with totally fresh and very naive eyes. I possessed an unwillingness to believe that failure was a real potential, despite all the evidence to the contrary. Having a keenly defined vision for the company I wanted to create was critical, and having a supportive partner, my husband, along with a not-so-chaotic home, really contributed to my ability to focus and work. But there were critical differences in the world in 89 than the world today that weighed heavily. After all, I don't think any of us can ever deny the impact of timing, place, and luck. There was no honor, certainly zero cachet, and even fewer rewards in being in farming, food, or restaurants. Charcuterie, craft beer, third wave coffee, artisanal breads were literally unheard of. Opening Cafe Potoshu in 1989 with its focus on farm fresh food, prepared from scratch using high quality ingredients, and served in an environment similar to a student union in a neighborhood might have been my most serious act of rebellion. And if you don't believe me, ask my parents, ask my mother. They were both first-generation Americans who thought that my working in a service industry was an embarrassing step backwards for them. In spite of being the first new tenant since 1942 at 49th and Penn, it took the Indianapolis Star nearly 3 years to notice that Potoshu had opened. The Indianapolis Monthly did not cover us for 4 years, and at the time, they reported on the fact that we used real turkey sandwich on sandwiches, because that was actually the story. Someone was serving real food that they actually made. I know. Crazy, huh? Potter's Shoe opened quietly in a total vacuum at a time when chain restaurants and regional shopping malls were where we ate and how we shopped. The internet would not be made available to the public for 3 years. Home computers, let alone laptops, did not exist. There were no smartphones, no social media, no Instagram, no Facebook, no Yelp. Farm to table as a phrase would not be uttered for nearly 20 years. Starbucks did not have one location in Indianapolis, and Whole Foods had not yet begun its expansion outside of its home market in Austin, Texas. Certainly, at some point, this new digital world, however, of technology ushered in globalization and urbanization. And in an urbanized America, people dine more outside of the home than they eat at home. In a digitized America, people crave the social experience of dining and connecting over food. And in a globalized world, people want both burgers and ramen in the same block in their neighborhood. And as a result today, food is cultural currency. Accumulation of cultural currency translates. The more you have, the more aware, in-tuned, urban, and urbane you are. Restaurants open today with unprecedented attention, including social media followers in the thousands. Restaurants are praised months before their doors are unlocked, their dangling Edison bulbs are turned on, and one plate of food is served, let alone eaten. Chefs have taken on celebrity status, and openings create newspaper headlines. And while my parents were mortified when I told them I was opening a restaurant, today, when daughters and sons pass up traditional four-year colleges and go to culinary schools, or they decide to become chefs and open up their own restaurants, quite honestly, parents today get the kind of bragging rights that make high school athletic teams' team pride pale by comparison. Stories of people who have made their fortunes expanding their restaurants and their personal food brands across the globe and into our living rooms are well known. I bet there's not one person in the audience who doesn't know who Bobby Flay or Mario Batali are. Martha Stewart went from being a caterer in Hartford, Connecticut, to a lifestyle mogul. I honestly will never understand Rachel Ray, and it has nothing to do with my point. I just needed to say that. Danny Myers made a reputed $600 million by taking his burger place Shake Shack public, and David Chang does Buick commercials and has his own line of Nike sneakers. An entire industry of food publicists, food journalists, food bloggers, food influencers has come into existence, all chasing this food culture. And millionaire and billionaire investors are investing in the most emerging of emerging restaurant concepts. But really, it's like cutting a tough steak with a really dull butter knife. The pressure that is on restaurants today is extreme. Everyone is a food expert. All of you are, in essence, food experts with the ability to be online critics. There are universal expectations regarding plating and decor. And truly, from the bottom of my heart, I pity the poorly trained barista unable to draw a perfect heart in the foam of a cappuccino. And admittedly, digital pressure creates business buzz and is great for the immediate bottom line, but it also creates serious limits on creativity. I'm fortunate. In 1989, I had total freedom to be unique and to be original. I was free from the pressures of the expectations that are now placed on restaurants. And even more importantly, I was allowed to make mistakes and given a chance to recover. If culturally food is currency, then restaurants clearly are the new banks. We are witnessing, as Claire noticed, an unprecedented national competition for cities to be seen as food destinations supported by hyper-local restaurant explosion. Food legends have been made for sure, and there are many souffles that have risen. Ask any city planner, any mayor, any developer, any economist. A robust restaurant scene is a prime indicator of a community's health and vitality. so much that I will even go so far as to say the restaurant industry might be the most important industry in our country today. A restaurant can change a neighborhood, provide jobs to those without skills, become a third place and a community anchor. When Potter Shoe started calling itself a student union for adults 29 years ago, I had no idea how true that would be. Restaurants have, since their inception, played an essential role in the life of cities. Today, restaurants lie at the heart of 21st century America, and for the foreseeable future, millions of Americans will wait tables, cook food, or wash dishes for their livelihood, and even more will dine out. So if you think that restaurants are merely places to get food, to have a meal, I really hope that today I can challenge you. Restaurants are much more than that. Restaurants are where world-changing ideas and revolutions have been sketched. And in case you think I'm referring to pre-revolutionary France, think about this. The year I entered high school, a group of students in New Orleans sat down at McCory's white-only lunch counter, refusing to leave until they were served. The students' subsequent arrest would be overturned by a landmark U.S. Supreme Court decision. And that's all really important. But what I think is even more amazing in terms of this conversation is that their organizational meeting occurred over spicy gumbo at Dookie Chase's restaurant, a restaurant that is still in existence today in New Orleans. Elvis's first Las Vegas contract was written on a restaurant tablecloth. We've seen house plans and business plans hatched on our napkins. There's a rumor, which I am going to continue to perpetuate today, that, seriously, I am, because no one's ever told me it didn't happen, that Peyton Manning had lunch at Cafe Potter Shoe at 49th and Penn after signing his original Colts contract. How amazing is that? Coach Brad Stevens came to the cafe the morning after Butler's NCAA lost to a standing ovation, and people gathered in silence and disbelief the morning of 9/11. Sure, restaurants are places where poets and writers and would-be revolutionaries hang out, but they're also places for first dates, post-funeral lunches, marriage proposals, major life cycle events, and daily cups of coffee with slices of cinnamon toast. Since fire was discovered, people have gathered around food, and there is nothing new in this, regardless of the year or the moment or the technological cycle we happen to be in. But just like all industries, there are challenges that really threaten to shake the restaurant equilibrium. Many, including industry stars such as Danny Myers and David Chang, believe that the business model the restaurants are based on itself is broken. High rents are not sustainable. Gentrification of neighborhoods is a collateral but serious social issue. The need for constant newness to appease customer demand is terrifying. The tipping system is seriously flawed, as was reflected by the great inequity between front of house and back of house workers. And menu prices are honestly too low to support any change in the model. There is rapid staff turnover, and profit margins are at historic lows, so much that there is truly more glitter than gold in the restaurant industry, as most operators struggle to achieve true profitability. Third-party delivery companies, grocery stores with prepared food and eat-in sections, and now even Amazon pose serious threat to an already fragile balance. High-powered investor groups hiding behind charismatic founders and chefs now control much of the restaurant world development. Soon, it is anticipated that there will be more restaurants owned by fewer and fewer people. Restaurant saturation may not be sustainable, and there is a real potential for a restaurant bubble. And there's also a continued threat to creativity and originality. What is original today in City A is subject to immediate duplication tomorrow in cities X, Y, and Z. This great derivativeness in the restaurant world threatens to create derivativeness in our cities, so much so that Kevin Alexander, a James Beard Award-winning journalist, in his James Beard Award-winning essay entitled, Why the New Food Town Must Die, state? Does anyone even know what city we're in? And does it matter? Well, I say it matters a lot. And because this is the Economics Club, I feel like I need to back this up with some numbers and data. Nearly 50% of all adults have at some point in their lives at least once worked in a restaurant, and over 25% of adults have worked their first job in a restaurant. 9 out of 10 restaurant managers started at an entry-level position. 80% of restaurants are owned by people who have started out in the bottom rung of the industry. 90% of restaurants have fewer than 50 employers, and 70% of all restaurants are single-unit operations. According to the National Restaurant Association, 4 out of 10 restaurants in the United States are owned by minorities. And although there is this impression that restaurant work is transitional and temporary, the truth of the matter is that for most of its employees, the bulk of their career years are spent in the industry. While restaurants do provide springboards for those entering the workforce, 58% of all workers are over 25, and 12% are over 55. This year alone, the national restaurant industry sales are expected to reach $800 billion, and 10% of the American workforce, over 15 million people, work in the industry. And just to put that in perspective, the next industry with workers only comes in under 10 million people. Ask anyone in the industry, though. I don't know if anyone's here in the industry, but if you went to any restaurant today and you asked the owner or manager, what is your most pressing challenge, they will say, yes, rents are high. Yes, there's unprecedented competition. Yes, originality gets really watered down very quickly. Yes, there's an ever-present need for the new. Yes, investment groups and third-party delivery all are really threatening to muddy the waters that are already cloudy. But the number one answer you will hear across the United States is that there is a serious, critical lack of bodies, skilled or unskilled, to fill the hiring gaps. But I think it's truly time to peel back the curtain on that assumption. I think the real question I think the real answer is, what are we in the restaurant industry doing to encourage people to come to the industry, and to what are we doing to make them stay in the industry? Let's pretend for a moment that there really are enough people to fill the hiring gaps. Too many of the jobs offered are low-paying with very little opportunity for growth. The hours are grueling, life-work balance is hard to obtain. Many workers are forced to work 2 and 3 jobs just to make ends meet. And those are really the easy challenges. Critically important to me is that there are significant and historic gender and race gaps that are just now being acknowledged, but hardly being solved. To me, this is my industry's major challenge. Women, people of color, and immigrants occupy the bottom rungs of the industry in far greater numbers than their white male counterparts. Fortune magazine cites that women and minorities get the worst job in the industries, and according to a report from the Restaurant Opportunity Center United, a labor advocacy group, women and workers of color are pushed into the lowest paying jobs in the food service industry. Workers of color earn 56% less than equally qualified white workers, controlling for language proficiency and education. White male food industry workers are channeled towards the highest paying jobs, such as bartenders, managers, and server jobs in fine dining establishments. Women are pushed towards lower paying jobs at casual restaurants, and people of color are channeled towards the even lower paying jobs, such as busing and kitchen positions. 81% of managers in the restaurant industry across the board are white and male. Gender bias literally bleeds over to other areas, including banking and media. In 2015, a mere 12% of venture capital went to support women-founded businesses. And that made me really sad until I realized, after doing research, that that was the high point. That percentage decreased by half to 6% in 2016, and this year it is projected that only 4% of VC money will go to female-founded businesses. That means 96% of all VC funds will get funneled to a male-founded business. And while venture capital certainly is not the sole way to raise funds or to expand a business, it is certainly a barometer on how our society values and supports women entrepreneurs. Food journalists, award organizations, and publications disproportionately reward and report on white male members of the industry over women, people of color, and immigrants. I was at Restaurant High just last week in DC, as I mentioned, and at Restaurant High, everyone was still talking about a New York Times article published over 5 years ago on the growing food scene. The New York Times article is famous in food circle because it failed to mention, although it was talking about top chefs and top restaurants, it failed to mention one female or one person of color. The James Beard Awards only recently began to include women and people of color as nominees in an even noticeable manner. And this isn't just, you know, these two organizations. Immediately after the 2016 Top 50 Restaurants in the World list was released, Eater, the most prominent food culture blog, asked this question: what's wrong with the world's best 50 list? Their answer: not a thing, unless you think a guy that overlooks an entire gender is okay. Now, you guys had to know that I was going to bring up Harvey Weinstein. And it's just too topical to ignore. It's also really part of the restaurant industry story. In the wake of the Weinstein scandal comes the ugly truth that predatory sexual business practices are not just limited to one industry. Several days after the Weinstein scandal broke, it was announced that John Besh, a James Beard award-winning New Orleans chef with 12 award-winning restaurants, was forced out of the company he founded after being accused of sexual harassment by 25 female employees. A few days after that, the award-winning Chicago restaurant Publican announced that both its executive chef and its general managers, both males, were being fired for inappropriate sexual harassment. Sadly, these are not isolated instances. Bro kitchen culture has not just ruled the restaurant industry. Bro kitchen norms have captured the imagination of and been rewarded by print media, award agencies, and customers alike. Bad boy chef behavior encourages bad boy chef culture. And I truly believe and I truly hope that we have reached an expiration date on this behavior. But if we're talking about sexual harassment, we have to be honest. We need to go beyond the binary. It's not just about the male versus female. We haven't even begun to openly acknowledge, let alone solve, the homophobic and transphobic behavior endemic in my industry. Pot au Chu is not immune from any of the outside challenges. We face high rents. We face mind-boggling levels of competition. We operate with the same pressures in the same market that all of my competition do. Admittedly, there are a lot of factors outside of our four walls that we cannot control. But it's what we can control that has allowed Pot au Chu to differentiate itself and to grow and prosper. From day one, we refused to adopt industry norms. We made food differently, we treated people differently, and we treated our community differently. Pot au Chu's norm-busting values not only defined our culture early, but it did so without a sacrifice to the quality of food, quality of staff opportunity, or quality of customer experience. And these norm-busting values strengthened our commitment to place leading up to the creation of the Pot au Chu Foundation almost 5 years ago. And addressing the industry's main challenge, we have attracted and retained staff. And while we too have turnover, because that's natural and part of any corporate life, we have defied the revolving door so known in the restaurant industry. And I believe we've defied it because we've created opportunities for those on all rungs. Today, we have an executive team that is 90% female, a leadership team at the cafe level that is 50% female. Our director of operations is female. We have managers who started off as bussers, lead concept people who started off as servers. The Parachute Foundation's executive director was recently, who is here with us today, Matthew Feltrop, was recently recognized as 30 under 30 in philanthropy by Forbes magazine. Last month, he met with members of the United States Congress regarding farm and school food policy and reform. He started off as a part-time host. Our production kitchen employs 6 cooks, 2 bakers, and 2 delivery truck drivers. It's in operation 7 days a week, nearly 20 hours a day. It is co-directed by a woman who started off as a part-time receptionist and a Hispanic man who started off literally chopping carrots. And critically important to Parachute's success, the men in our organization add to, benefit from, and participate in Parachute culture as much as the women do. I knew, by extension, that my daughters would likely be feminists. To paraphrase poet Maya Angelou, they are females. They'd be stupid to not be on their own team. But I made sure that my son understood his responsibility and his role, too, in being a champion for gender equality. I would be a hypocrite to not ask that of all the men in my personal and professional lives, including those who are part of the Parachute team. And I owe a debt of gratitude to the men who, especially in the face of overwhelming kitchen culture that exists in our industry today, I owe a debt of gratitude to the men on our team who actively promote and live by Parachute values. There is tremendous organizational buzz today about employee engagement, with the idea that the more engaged employees are, the happier they will be. And I imagine most of your companies talk about how to engage their staff better. And I get that engagement is important. After all, people should know what their jobs are, they should understand their jobs, and they should be focused while at work. But I don't believe for a minute that it's engagement, that engagement is what makes people happy. I don't believe engagement is what creates healthy company culture. I think we're all fooling ourselves. Engagement benefits the business way more than it benefits staff. The Parachute method since day one has always been engagement coupled by an extremely healthy dose of employee enrichment. Enrichment is the true path to establishing trust, creating loyalty, and building culture. So what do we do to enrich employees' lives? We focus on providing livable wages. We offer opportunities to build wealth. We offer subsidized healthcare benefits, and we have a company match 401k plan. We conduct regularly scheduled financial literacy workshops, and we have a company-seeded emergency assistance plan known as the Peer Fund, which is administered 100% by staff. This plan is open for all, regardless of tenure or position, with the goal of helping staff in their times of need when normal safety nets such as family or insurance fail. We have a Parachute staff assistance plan that offers free legal advice and psychological counseling 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. We offer continuing education and training, both at the culinary and service level, and we have a leadership pipeline that offers opportunities for career growth, including a clearly defined career path. And there is an open door to my office that has existed since day one. But we're not stopping there. I will be announcing at our end of year offsite retreat some new things that we're doing at Parachute to better help our staff. Starting in 2018, we are going to be offering financial and administrative support for our culinary team members to further their professional education and skills by helping them to secure stage opportunities in best of class restaurants in other areas of the country and world. We will offer full-time employees credit and reimbursement for taking classes. We will improve on our maternity leave and offer a limited support care leave for full-time members of our team. A workplace should add value in addition to a paycheck. The restaurant industry is as ripe for disruption and innovation as it was in 1989 when Potter Shoe first opened its doors. Disruption then came in the form of serving real turkey on homemade bread. But today, disruption has to be much greater. We have to do more. It's not disruptive to simply open new restaurants in old buildings in transitioning neighborhoods. And it is no more disruptive to open new restaurants in new developments off of highways. Disruption has to be more than trying to be the next great food city. Growth for the sake of growth borders on pure vanity that ignores purpose and makes only short-term changes in the lives of people. Potter Shoe has lived an absolute reality that profitability can exist without exploitation of the people who make success possible, and that profitability can exist while giving back to the community. If we have achieved this for nearly 30 years, I really think others in the industry can do so too. And I go back to the Yeats poem, "I've spread my dreams under your feet, tread softly because you tread on my dreams." I also believe that we should not tread, that we should also tread softly on other people's dreams. I've been remarkably fortunate. Every day I wake up knowing that I won the absolute job lottery. And every night I go to sleep thankful for the abundance that the restaurant industry has brought to my life. Restaurants do change neighborhoods, and neighborhoods do change cities. But I do believe it is time for the most representative industry in Teddy Roosevelt's most representative city to truly become representative. After all, opportunity to all just might be the tide that lifts all boats. Thank you very much.
There. Wow, that was really wonderful. Thank you, Martha.
Thank you.
As a reminder, please send up your white cards or tweet at Economic Club IN if you have questions for Martha. We have about 10 minutes. So while I'm waiting for those to arrive, I'm going to ask you a couple questions. First of all, I think I've been saying it wrong all these years. Is it Potter Shoe, Potter Shoe? What's the story behind the name? What does it mean? Why did you select that name?
Well, Potter Shoe, you can say it any way you want. As long as you come in, I don't care. But I really don't. The proper pronunciation is Potter Shoe. Okay. And it goes back years ago. I worked for then prosecutor Steve Goldsmith in his sex crimes unit. And I was probably an annoyance to him, a tremendous annoyance. I was on the outer inner circle, not on the inner circle by any means. And I used to always run into his office and say things like, if we just educated people and taught them to read, I think we could cut crime way back. And if we just got people jobs, I think we could, you know, do a lot to impact our city. And he always called me a cream puff. Well, Potter Shoe is French for cream puff. So, yeah.
That's really great. Well, speaking of which, maybe not speaking of which, you talked about a very topical and controversial issue, sexual harassment, and you talked about how that's impacted the food and restaurant industry. I'm wondering, for those of us in the room here who are not in that industry, what role we could play as paying customers to try to help address that issue and make it a better place for the employees who work there?
Well, that's a wonderful question, and I think customers always have the ability. Their role is that they can vote with their feet and they can support restaurants where they know the cultures are healthy and safe for all employees. That's part of the secret. That's part of the veil that exists, is that you don't really know, if you're not in the industry, what restaurants are promoting what is now called bro kitchen culture. But you kind of do know. And it's very pervasive. And I would say so many of you know people in the restaurant business, ask them what they think. But I do think you always have the opportunity to vote totally with your feet and your pocketbook.
Well, changing topics, you talked about getting into the restaurant industry when the term farm to table didn't even exist, and it was a big news story when it was actually real turkey on homemade bread. Mm-hmm. Kind of amazing to believe that. Tell us what it was like during those early years to be an entrepreneur. What were some of the biggest, or what was the biggest challenge you faced, and how did you get through that?
I don't think there was a single big challenge. I think it was all challenging. And I got through it, honestly. I mentioned this in my talk. Having a supportive husband, a supportive partner was remarkably helpful. But there weren't a lot of mentors in 1989, especially for women who were really doing something not traditional. I think it was accepted if you wanted to be a lawyer or a teacher or a doctor, maybe, but it was really unacceptable in 1989, regardless of gender, to open up a restaurant. So to answer your question, there were tons of challenges, but I was so naive and so dumb that I did not look at them as challenges. I'm a real Pollyanna, and I looked at them as incredible opportunities. And I know that sounds really trite, but it's true. It didn't occur to me that I've said this before, I had zero plan B, and it truly never occurred to me that I wouldn't make this work. I also believe strongly, I'm kind of what I call my ambition is micro. Doesn't mean I'm not ambitious. I'm like really ambitious and really competitive, but did this just go off?
Back on, I think.
But I didn't set out in 1989 to, by 2020, own 15 restaurants and have, 1,000 employees. I didn't have this big vision. I had this micro vision. And it really helped me, and it's helped me since then, to have what I call micro ambitions. And to just say, hey, if I can get this done, then I'm going to get to the next level. And then when I'm at the next level, I'll figure out the next level of issues and challenges. But none of the challenges that I was faced with in 89, none of them were so bad or so difficult that it bothered me, to be honest.
Good for you. I'm going to switch topics here with some of the questions from the audience, asking a little bit about some of the steps that you're taking to try to address the inequity in pay and also across gender and race. Can you talk a little bit about what minimum wage should be? How would we completely blow up the tipping that you talked about that you think is that model being broken?
Well, I believe strongly in free market, and I just at Restaurant High, over half of the conversations in small groups were with people who lived in California, specifically with restaurant owners who lived in the Bay Area. And having the government, I'm really not an economist, so I can't give you guys all the statistics and numbers. I think that it is foolish to think if you just raise the minimum raise that the minimum wage, that you automatically take care of the problem. The problem isn't what happens at entry level. The problem is what happens once you're in the entry level. The problem, and I was hoping to really address that in my talk, the problem is lack of opportunity. So the real problem is that people come into the restaurant industry at young ages or not having the skill set necessary. But so many of those people, especially if they're in one of those three groups, if they're a person of color, a female, or an immigrant, they are stuck. They are not given the opportunity. So wages improve and increase as opportunity improves and increase. And we just have to get restaurant owners to understand it's not just what you pay someone at the bottom, it's what you do with them to make sure that they don't stay at the bottom.
You talked a little bit about the Potashew Foundation and some of the work that you're doing and your colleague here with you in the room today with food insecure children. Tell us a little bit about what you have learned through that work. What has surprised you? What has inspired you?
What has both surprised and inspired me are the parents of the children that we serve. I think that as somebody who has lived in a bubble most of my life, a bubble of, you know, relative. My father was a physician. I was born in the right zip code, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I had opportunities. And even though I had challenges, I had opportunities. And I think that we all come to work in not-for-profits with a little bit of judgment about the people that we are serving. And what has surprised me and made me the happiest is that the people we are serving, the parents have a, I understand now, they have a burden placed on them by their poverty and their lack of opportunity that is unimaginable by anybody probably sitting in this room, because I am assuming that most of you were born in the right zip codes too. And I think one of the biggest challenges we face is removing that judgment of the people that we serve. They want the opportunities. I have not met a parent, and Matthew, maybe you can speak to this too. We have not met one parent who is not interested in what we are doing, nor have we met one parent who does not have remarkable shame and sadness for being unable to feed their own children, their children, the quality of food that we're feeding the kids. They want more for their kids. It's just like the people who work for us at all levels. Everyone's got dreams for their own lives and dreams for their children's lives. And these people are no different than that. So they are remarkably, they partner with us. They want more for their kids. And I think that's the most impressive thing I've learned.
Well, you mentioned that we're in this room all very lucky to be here, to have this wonderful lunch we had today, and probably to have warm homes and great food over the Thanksgiving holiday just around the corner. For those of us in the room here who are moved by what you've just talked about poverty and hunger, what are some of the things that we can do to address the immediate need to address people who are hungry, and then also help play a role in addressing root causes of hunger in our community?
Well, I this isn't a fundraiser, but everything in essence is a fundraiser. It takes money to make even a small organization such as ours work and work properly. We set out to prove, when I started the foundation, I had a couple of goals in mind. And one of the goals was that we would be able to start small, grow sustainably and strategically, just the way the company has, but that we would make an immediate impact. I also wanted to prove that you didn't need to have millions of dollars, although I would love to have millions of dollars in our foundation, but I don't think that's what's necessary to make to making a change in a community. If you add up all the money that is donated to charities and not-for-profits in the United States, even in our city, and you see that there is still so much need, you kind of go, what's the deal here? Where is the gap? Why aren't we solving more of these needs? So you ask, how can people help to solve the needs? They can first and foremost give to organizations that share the values that you guys have. They can give to organizations such as the Potter Shoe Foundation. But one thing we really encourage is you can actually do the work. It's one thing to write a check. It's another thing to actually develop relationships with the people that we're serving and really impact a life on a one-to-one, face-by-face basis. And that's something that I think you can only do by getting your hands dirty.
Well, I'm sure you've probably inspired some entrepreneurs to be in the room here today. So can you close with some words of wisdom for those of us who might want to become entrepreneurs, either advice you received from a mentor or something that you learned in your career that could benefit those of us in the room?
You know, in 1989, there weren't very many people who wanted to mentor me. And a couple of years ago, I actually was at an event, and someone, a man, introduced himself as my original mentor. And I thought it was really funny because I don't remember him telling me anything of consequence. My word of wisdom is that I think it is time, especially under the umbrella of women supporting women. I wish that I had had some strong female advisors and mentors. In 1989, I was jumping in to the deep end of the pool. I had three children, one of whom was a brand new baby. I had a husband who was also in his career building days. And it was a very confusing world. And I wish I just had the opportunity to meet and talk with other people about how they are getting things done so that I didn't feel like I was always swimming upstream. And in light of that, I think that especially the women in this room who are doing what I'm doing, and there are plenty of you doing your own thing and being successful in your careers, I think it's time that we really open up and say to other women coming up, we'll mentor you, we'll help you, we'll support you. We will share our information. Information, the one thing we talk about in our company all the time is that information should not be hoarded. And I do think the more we communicate and help others by sharing information, the better it is for everybody.
Well, thank you for the delicious food that your restaurants make. Thank you for the work you're doing with your foundation and elsewhere. And also thank you for your wonderful remarks today. Please join me in thanking Martha Hooper.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a speech from the Economic Club, part of the 2017-2018 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Join us next month at this time for the panel discussion, Education Today, moderated by Indiana Commissioner for Higher Education, Teresa Lubbers, with Butler University President James Danko, Marion University President Dan Elsner, and University of Indianapolis President Rob Manuel. You can find more information at economicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.